Leviticus 4, verses 1 through 21. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the people of Israel, saying, If anyone sins unintentionally in any of the Lord's commandments about things not to be done, and does any one of them, if it is the anointed priest who sins, thus bringing guilt on the people, then he shall offer for the sin that he has committed a bull from the herd without blemish to the Lord for a sin offering. He shall bring the bull to the entrance of the tent of meeting before the Lord, and lay his hand on the head of the bull, and kill the bull before the Lord. And the anointed priest shall take some of the blood of the bull and bring it into the tent of meeting, and the priest shall dip his finger in the blood and sprinkle part of the blood seven times before the Lord in front of the veil of the sanctuary. And the priest shall put some of the blood on the horns of the altar of fragrant incense before the Lord that is in the tent of meeting, and all the rest of the blood of the bull he shall pour out at the base of the altar of burnt offering, that is at the entrance of the tent of meeting. And all the fat of the bull of the sin offering he shall remove from it, the fat that covers the entrails, and all the fat that is on the entrails, and the two kidneys with the fat that is on them at the loins, and the long lobe of the liver, that he shall remove with the kidneys, just as these are taken from the ox of the sacrifice of the peace offerings. And the priest shall burn them on the altar of burnt offering. But the skin of the bull and all its flesh, with its head, its legs, its entrails, and its dung, all the rest of the bull, he shall carry outside the camp to a clean place, to the ash heap, and shall burn it up on a fire of wood. On the ash heap it shall be burned up. If the whole congregation of Israel sins unintentionally, and the thing is hidden from the eyes of the assembly, and they do any one of the things that by the Lord's commandments ought not to be done, and they realize their guilt, when the sin which they have committed becomes known, the assembly shall offer a bull from the herd for a sin offering, and bring it in front of the tent of meeting. And the elders of the congregation shall lay their hands on the head of the bull before the Lord, and the bull shall be killed before the Lord. Then the anointed priest shall bring some of the blood of the bull into the tent of meeting, and the priest shall dip his finger in the blood and sprinkle it seven times before the Lord in front of the veil. And he shall put some of the blood on the horns of the altar that is in the tent of meeting before the Lord, and the rest of the blood he shall pour out at the base of the altar of burnt offering that is at the entrance of the tent of meeting. And all its fat he shall take from it and burn on the altar. Thus shall he do with the bull. As he did with the bull of the sin offering, so shall he do with this. And the priest shall make atonement for them, and they shall be forgiven. And he shall carry the bull outside the camp, and burn it up as he burned up the first bull. It is the sin offering for the assembly.
We're in the book of Leviticus, and Leviticus is in the very center of the first five books of our Old Testament. So the first five books of our Old Testament are often called the Pentateuch or the Torah. And they're all written by a guy named Moses. Now, the Pentateuch starts in the Garden of Eden. And according to the book of Ezekiel, this garden is actually on a mountain. It's the mountain of God, is this Garden of Eden at the beginning. But very quickly, in the book of Genesis, we go from being on the mountain of God with God to pretty soon, the people of God are in a valley, literally. They're in the Nile Valley of Egypt, and they're away from the land of God. They're away from God's presence, and they're no longer on a mountain with God, but they're in the valley. Here in Leviticus, we've moved again in the Pentateuch. We've come out of the valley, and now we're gathered at the mountain Sinai. So if you're following the geography of the Pentateuch, we go from the Garden of God and the mountain of God into the valley away from the mountain of God. And now we're back at the mountain where God's revealing himself. And we're in the book of Leviticus as this happens. Leviticus is helping us see that the gate to the presence of God that was shut by sin is being opened again. The Garden of Eden was closed off from humanity with a cherubim, with a flaming sword. And now we're at this tabernacle where the curtains have the cherubim on them. And there's the burning altar between the people and those cherubim. And the question is, who shall ascend the mount of the Lord? Who will dwell on God's holy hill with God? This is the question that Leviticus provokes us to answer. Last week in Leviticus, we read about a specific offering called the burnt offering. Now, the primary significance of the burnt offering that we read about last week is that the whole animal is burned on the altar in the presence of the Lord. That's the significant thing to note about that offering. The worshiper who brings the animal presses his hands down on the animal's head. That ritually signifies the identification of life for life, death for death. In that first offering, the whole burnt offering, the worshiper communicates, "My whole life is devoted to the presence of the living God and is to be transformed." The emphasis of that first offering was full devotion and transformation. That was chapter 1. Now we're in chapter 4, and there's a different offering being discussed. It's the sin offering. And what we'll notice about the sin offering is two specific things that it signifies. The sin offering is not signifying full devotion and transformation. The sin offering signifies separation from sin and the destruction of sin. So we're going to look at those two main things that we read in Leviticus 4. Separation from sin and the destruction of sin. So as we look at chapter 4, let's highlight the similarities between chapter 1 and chapter 4. So first, similarities. What do the whole burnt offering and what do the sin offering share in common? Well, we see a number of things if we just skim through our text. We see that an animal without blemish is to be offered. That's exact same. We see that the worshiper presses his hands down on the head of the animal, a sign of the substitution about to take place, life for life, death for death. We also see that there's blood poured out on the altar for burnt offerings. That's the same in chapter 1 and chapter 4. And then we also see a discussion of entrails, which we don't usually come to church to hear about entrails, but there we are, kidneys and livers. Those also are being burned on the altar. These are all the similarities between the burnt offering and the sin offering. An animal without blemish, the laying on of hands, blood being poured out at the altar for burnt offerings, and guts. But the real importance of the sin offering in Israelite worship is not the similarities to the burnt offering. It's the ways that this offering is different. That's the most important stuff for us to think about. How is this offering different? Well, in chapter 1 with the burnt offering, that's a unified offering, we could say. All of the blood has a single destination. And all of the body has a single destination. Did you remember that from chapter 1? All of the blood goes to the base of the altar, and all of the body gets burned on the altar. So the burnt offering is a unified offering. It all goes to the same destination. The sin offering is divided. Do you see that in our text? The blood has different destinations. Into the curtain, onto the horns of the altar, into the ground at the base of actually a different altar. The body gets divided. Some of the entrails, the kidney, liver, and fat, go on the altar, but the rest of the body goes away to a clean place outside the camp. We see a separation in the blood, and we see a destruction of the body. This feature of the sin offering is unique from the burnt offering. What does it mean, though? What does it mean that the blood has multiple destinations and that the body is separated? Well, let's think about what Leviticus 4 is saying. In verse 1 of chapter 4, we see that the Lord speaks to Moses again. And he says, "Speak to the people of Israel," verse 2, saying, "If anyone sins unintentionally in any of the Lord's commandments about the things not to be done and does any one of them." So chapter 4 is actually not about every kind of sin. Chapter 4 is about a specific kind of sin, an unintentional sin. Now, Rick read for us two paragraphs. Chapter 4 has multiple paragraphs that deal with different kinds of people who sin. We have the anointed priest who sins. Then in verse 13, we have the whole assembly sins. In verse 22, a leader who sins. And verse 27, a common person that sins. But the similarity between all of these kinds of people that sin is that they're unintentional sins. We'll learn in the book of Numbers, chapter 15, that there's actually no atonement for intentional sin in the Levitical law. People who sin intentionally in the Levitical system were to be cut off from Israel, and it says that he or she would bear their iniquity. As people of the New Testament, we actually read something fairly similar in the New Testament. If we go on sinning deliberately after receiving the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a fearful expectation of judgment and a fury of fire that will consume the adversaries. If we receive knowledge of truth, and then we choose to continue living in sin, there's no sacrifice for that. God is gracious, but God cannot be tricked. If God's people love sin more than God, they will not enter his presence. If we go through our day to day loving sin more than God, we should not expect to be welcomed into his presence. We might do many good things for the church, for other Christians, but the day will come and we'll say, "Lord, Lord, did we not?" And he'll say, "I did not know you." God is gracious. He's lavishly abundant with his forgiveness. But he cannot be tricked. What do you love this morning? What do your actions show that you love? That's what's at work in Leviticus 4. In fact, our prayer as true worshipers of God should be the prayer of Psalm 19. Declare me innocent from unintentional sins. Declare me innocent from hidden faults. Keep back your servant also from presumptuous sins. The language of Psalm 19 assumes that there are both unintentional sin and presumptuous sin. And the prayer of that worshiper is that he would be declared innocent of the hidden sins and that he be kept back from the presumptuous sins. Let them not have dominion over me, then I shall be blameless and innocent of great transgression. The prayer of Psalm 19 that we spent 3 weeks thinking about is the prayer of the Leviticus 4 worshiper. Cleanse me from the hidden sins and keep me back from presumptuous sin. This is the heart of the true worshiper of God. In this path to forgiveness, in the Leviticus chapter 4 path to forgiveness, we notice that the verse 3, the anointed priest who sins and thereby brings guilt on the people, that he shall offer for the sin that he's committed a bull from the herd without blemish of the Lord for a sin offering. He'll bring the bull to the entrance of the tent of meeting before the Lord, lay his hands on the head of the bull, and kill the bull before the Lord. That's all the same as the law of the burnt offering. Here is where the difference begins. Verse 5, and the anointed priest shall take some of the blood of the bull. So he's going to take a portion of the blood and he's going to take it to a different location. The blood is going to be separated. And the priest, he'll bring it into the tent of meeting. So now we've gone from the outer courts of the tabernacle, where there's an altar for burnt offerings. There's a big old basin of water. He goes into the tent. That's the third in row. He goes into the tent. And in this tent, there's a curtain that divides two halves. You have the holy places where the priest can enter regularly. You have the most holy place that the priest can only enter once a year on the Day of Atonement. The priest goes into that first segment and he goes up to that curtain. On these curtain are stitched the cherubim that are guarding access into the most holy place. And in front of these knitted cherubim, in front of this curtain, he takes the blood and he dips his finger and he shakes it 7 times. And he sprinkles this blood on the ground in front of the cherubim on the curtains. That's step one. Then he takes that same bowl of blood and he goes to the altar of incense. Now the altar of incense is in this tent in front of these cherubim. And there's incense burning on it. And now he takes some of the blood, and step two, he smears the blood on the corners that point upward on that altar. They're called the horns of the altar. Puts blood on that altar of incense. And then step three, he takes the rest of the blood, and he goes out back to the altar of the burnt offerings. And he pours out the rest of the blood at the base of the altar for burnt offerings. The blood goes 3 places in this offering. Last week, we discussed from Leviticus 17 that blood has ritual and symbolic importance in this Levitical system. The life of the animal is in the blood. That's what Leviticus 17 tells us. You shall not drink the blood because in it is the life. As the priest shakes his finger and rubs the altar horns and dumps the rest of it into the ground, what the priest is doing is sprinkling life where there was death, spreading life where there was death, and pouring out life where there was death. Sprinkled at the feet of the cherubim, wiped on the horns of the altar, poured into the earth of the ground. The blood is going in multiple dimensions. This blood has multiple directions of atonement. And what we realize is that sin, even the unintentional sin, we could say even the white lie, sin fractures the human life. Sin fractures the human existence. in a complex way. There's multiple dimensions of atonement needed in sin. As we follow the blood trail, we need to think about where the blood goes. Because where the blood goes is where the forgiveness goes. Where the blood goes is where the life goes. The repeated refrain of chapter 4 is this phrase, "He shall be forgiven." We saw that one time in the text that Rick read for us, verse 20, "They shall be forgiven." But then we see it in verse 26, "He shall be forgiven." We see it in verse 31, "He shall be forgiven." We see it in verse 35, "He shall be forgiven." The hope of Leviticus 4 is forgiveness. What does this forgiveness mean for us? As a worshiper of the living God, who's instituted a sacrificial system for forgiveness, we have to navigate intellectual assent from true reception. It's one thing to intellectually assent that God forgives sin. But it's another thing to believe that He forgives your sin. Isn't that true for us? It's one thing to sing together on Sunday morning about how shall I be free from sin. It's another thing to live Monday to Saturday knowing that you're free from sin. The echo of Leviticus 4, "And he shall be forgiven, and he shall be forgiven, and he shall be forgiven." That echo is meant to linger in our minds and dig down into our hearts. Those of us who have the sacrifice appointed by God in Jesus Christ are forgiven. But experientially, I know this for me, and I assume for most of us, we're often prone to linger over a sense of guilt and shame over past sins we've committed or past sins committed against us. Isn't that true for you? That often we still feel guilty or we still feel shame. Now, if you're not a Christian this morning, if you're not following the risen Christ, when you feel guilt and shame, it's a good thing. That's called conviction of sin. That's the Holy Spirit working in your heart to help you see that you need Leviticus 4. If you're not a Christian and you feel guilt and shame, that's designed by God to show you that you need to be forgiven. The message of the gospel is that you can be forgiven. So if you're already a Christian this morning, that's our meditation of the morning. He shall be forgiven. It could be that you're in a season this morning where you struggle to receive God's forgiveness personally. It could be in a season this morning where guilt and shame seem to be the lingering aftertaste of your spiritual life. Let's think about the imagery here to encourage us. If that's you this morning, zoom in on the imagery. Let's follow the blood. Where does the blood go this morning? Well, the blood goes to the feet of the cherubim. It goes to the horns of the altar, and the blood goes to the earth. Think of that multi-dimension covering of life in the face of death. Think of that multi-dimension covering signifying forgiveness in the place of uncleanness. As a worshiper of Jesus Christ this morning, we might ask ourselves, where can I go where precious blood has not paved the way? That's what Leviticus 4 begs us to ask. Where can I go where precious blood has not already paved the way? Can I go into the presence of God? Blood has paved the way. Can I go to God in prayer? Blood has paved the way. Can I go to the grave? Blood has paved the way. You see, this blood goes before the worshiper. This blood covers the ground into the holy places. This blood covers the horns of the altar as the incense rises. And this blood saturates the earth that will one day receive the worshiper's body. Do you see, Christian? There is nowhere that you can go that blood has not paved the way. The imagery of Leviticus 4 is important for us. We no longer shed the bloods of bulls and goats and sheep to pave our way. But make no mistake, blood was shed. That blood has paved a way. Christian, wherever you walk, wherever you pray, wherever you lay down to give up your spirit at the end of your journey, Jesus will be there. Jesus will have paved the way with his blood so that you can be forgiven and received. In a world broken by guilt and shame and sin, this message is easy to say and it's hard to believe. But believing it is the work of faith. If you have doubt over the forgiveness that Christ offers for your sin today, it's the work of faith to receive. Having followed the blood, now we get to follow the body. The blood has two destinations. The blood has three destinations, and the body, we see, has two destinations. The blood in verse 7 has just been poured out at the base of the altar of burnt offerings. And then verse 8. And now we're talking about the fat. And all the fat of the bull of the sin offering will get removed. The fat that covers the entrails and all the fat that's on the entrails and the two kidneys with the fat that's on them at the loins and the long lobe of the liver he shall remove with the kidneys. And the priest shall burn these on the altar of burnt offering. So there's some stuff getting burnt within the tabernacle, in the presence of God. And it's the best stuff. I know that I don't get very excited when you serve kidney soup for supper. Nor do I get excited when you serve liver and onions for supper. But in this time, this day and time, these are choice parts. There's a phrase in Deuteronomy that in our English Bibles gets translated, the very finest wheat. Sounds very nice. But in the Hebrew, it's actually the fat of the kidneys of the wheat. Oh, weird. But it signifies that this is fine dining. The fat and the kidneys and the liver. The best is going to be on the altar to be burned in the presence of the Lord. But the rest of it, all of the rest of it, the skin and the organs and the flesh, those are all going to go outside the camp. They're going to go away from the presence of God, away from the tent of meeting, away from where God is dwelling. And it's going to be burned at a distance on a bunch of ashes. The sin offering represents separation from sin. The blood gets divided up. The body gets divided up. And when the body gets burned, there's a word used that's not used in chapter 1. It's a word that means something like destroy. Whereas the burnt offering is fully devoted and transformed. The sin offering is simply destroyed. It's simply consumed. Now, if you keep reading past where Rick read, there's actually a different procedure for sins of individuals than for the sin of the whole assembly. When the priest sins, bringing sins on everyone, and when the whole assembly sins, then blood goes into the tent and the body goes outside the camp. But if it's an individual who sins, the blood does not go into the tent and the body does not go outside the camp. Instead, the blood goes into the ground and the body gets eaten by the priests. That does not happen with the burnt offering. And whether the body is destroyed here in Leviticus 4 by being burnt on an ash heap or getting eaten by the priest, the picture is the same. This sacrifice is being consumed and destroyed. What Leviticus 4 helps us see is that the body of sin must be destroyed before our lives can be acceptable to God. The order of sacrifice is sin offering first, then burnt offering, then the peace offering. The sin offering deals with sin. The burnt offering deals with devotion. And the peace offering is a feast. The peace offering is the meal that you sit and share with all who would partake. Worship of God deals with sin. It presents us as devoted to the Lord. And then there's a banquet where we sit in the dwelling place of God with the brothers and sisters that God has brought together, and we enjoy all the benefits that God's life brings us. Leviticus 4 tells us that sin must be dealt with, but sin is not our ultimate destination. Dealing with sin is the first step of worship, but not the ultimate step. Does that make sense? Sin has to be dealt with, but dealing with sin is not an end in itself. Dealing with sin takes us on a journey. We go from sin offering to burnt offering to peace offering. We go from the offering that deals with our sin to the offering that devotes our life to the worship of this God, to then the offering where we banquet in the house of God. The same is true of the Christian life. The goal of the Christian life is not simply to be separated from our sin. That's not the goal of the Christian life, to simply be holy, pure, and blameless. Is it necessary? Yes. Is it the end goal? No. The goal of the Christian life is to dwell in the presence of God forever. That's the goal of the Christian life. The Christian life is the life that says, I want to dwell in your house forever. A day in your courts is better than 1,000 years elsewhere. This is the destination of the Christian life, that the dwelling place of God will be with man forever. Dealing with sin is not the end goal of the Christian life, but it is the necessary step by which we're able to enter the presence of God. Our worship today no longer requires a bull or a sheep or a goat. We have a much better sacrifice. We have the sacrifice of the Son of God, a permanent sacrifice made once for all. But the steps of our worship are the same. We address our sin to God. We devote our lives to God. And then we enjoy God's presence. We enjoy God's presence. We live with fellowship with one another. We forgive each other's sins as we've been forgiven. We put away bitterness. We put away pride. and we enjoy. We enjoy that consuming fire of whom we can dwell in his presence and not be consumed. When we read the book of Leviticus, I assume that it feels burdensome to us. And I assume that because I read it and I think, well, I wouldn't want to do that. And as I've read it with many of you this week, our conversations often ended, I'm so glad that I don't live then. With almost everyone I read this text with this week, that's our conclusion. I'm so glad we have it simpler. Simpler? Yes. Easier? I don't think so. Because Jesus taught us some hard things. He taught us that the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. He taught us that if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. Jesus taught us that whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. At the level of ritual, our faith is so much simpler than these guys' faith. That's true. But don't confuse simpler with cheaper. Don't confuse simpler with easier. If you're going to follow Jesus, the supreme sacrifice made by God for us, it will cost us everything. It will cost us everything to follow Jesus. The question today is not the price of following Jesus, but the worth of following Jesus. Is the price worth it? Do we want to live out our life for a handful of good things? For some kidneys and fat? Or do we want to live our life holding on to the greatest thing? Fellowship with God forever. This is the basic trade-off we all need to decide. And it's not a cheap, easy trade-off. This is a costly trade-off. But we must press into the question, what are we living for? What are we living for? Is our life oriented toward the presence of God? Or is our life oriented towards nice things that we can acquire in the span of 80 years and then go to the ash heap? Those are the two options that Leviticus 4 gives us. We can orient our lives toward the presence of God, following the path that He has provided that's narrow and hard and costly, but that is sure. And that on that path, there is no place you can step where precious blood has not paved the way. Or we can simply pursue the good things that this life offers, that we know are headed to the ash heap, and yet we hold on to it. All of us are going to go to the ash heap. Not all of us are going to go to the presence of God. The choice that Leviticus 4 presses us to this day is, where will you go? Will we go to the place of forgiveness, where there is a feast waiting? Or will we cling to our sin, not put it to death, love it, and then die with it? Today, the day of salvation is open to us. If we would receive the sacrifice, if we would give up our life, and if we would follow Jesus, then we can live abundantly forever in the presence of God at His table. The priest shall make atonement for him, for his sin, and he shall be forgiven. This is the hope of the gospel, church. Let's live in this hope today. Pray with me.